confusing, and people think points to some underlying physics beyond the Standard Model must show up. So that's going to be essentially how we finish up. And just to remind you, and maybe to open in case there's any questions remaining, we talked a little bit last time about one thing that we did in the Standard Model is we neglected these operator forms, which, you know, they're dimension four because all the tilde means is that we have, you know, an epsilon tensor and a field strength. So this is a dual field. But this is dimension four, and kind of the selling point of the Standard Model, one of its selling points is that we just write down everything up to dimension four, and then we just fit it from the data, and then everything just kind of works, right? And in terms of the assumed symmetries and field content. But there's, if you look a little deeper, there is this underlying issue of arguable inconsistency in the Standard Model, which is that, you know, what about these dimension four operator forms? So there's three things you could write down because we have three different gauge fields in the Standard Model. You could potentially write down this, which is dimension four. You could potentially write down the field strength dual operator form of this with some Wilson coefficient. And last time we talked a little bit about how when it comes to abelian fields, we started to look into how we took divergences of some symmetry currents, and we started to understand that these operator forms had to do with asymptotic field configurations at infinity. So because this is a trivial U1 in the Standard Model, the asymptotic field configurations for such U1 fields are simpler. You kind of literally unwind them to make them so that this sort of thing is not something you need to keep to extend the Standard Model, combined with the fact that it's a total derivative. This one was a little bit more complicated in the sense of when we actually looked at baryon number currents and lepton number currents, we saw that there was these operator forms were generated. So if we looked at d mu and then some baryon current and d mu with a lepton current, where the baryon number currents and lepton number currents were just the sum, they were just these vector currents plus d bar gamma mu d plus so on and so forth, and the same thing for the leptons, that these actually generate these operator forms, but that b minus l was something that was, it generated the same sort of operator form. So you could imagine doing symmetry transformations of baryon minus lepton number to basically use that symmetry transformation to remove these from something you need to consider when starting to do calculations in the Standard Model. But we don't have both baryon and lepton number currents in QCD, and so we ended up with basically having to then start to look at this particular structure, which is the last thing to consider, and see why is it that we can neglect this, or can we neglect this in QCD and in the Standard Model? Okay, so is there any residual, this stuff gets into a bit, and I'm going to try and flesh out in quite a bit of detail the axial anomaly in QCD and the strong CP problem in this whole like next hour as a final discussion. It really gets into a lot of subtle field theory, which, you know, it's hard to kind of get through it all because there's just a lot of detailed subtle math calculations. So I'm trying to give you a conceptual overview of what's going on. But in doing so, it might have been a bit quick. Was there any residual questions about how this discussion went last time before we go on to the QCD discussion? Everything sitting well? Okay, if something comes up or if this QCD discussion kind of generates, it'll probably generate more understanding as to what we said last time, but if it generates more questions, we can come back to this as well. Okay, so we're going to try and figure out how do we think about this operator form, which is the one kind of last thing that up to dimension four that we haven't discussed in full detail, okay? So it's intimately tied with something called the axial anomaly. Remember, you have both vector currents and axial currents. A vector current is just psi bar gamma mu psi, whereas an axial current is psi bar gamma mu gamma five psi. So, and like in the case where there were B minus L symmetry transformations to remove this, you have to be a bit careful when considering this operator form, because the massless quark limit, you know, there's an enhanced symmetry that happens in QCD. And that enhanced symmetry was characterized by just taking the masses to zero and then starting to think about how QCD transitioned over at low energies with bound states of QQ bar into a chiral perturbation theory description. And then the masses control the breaking of that enhanced symmetry. But there's an enhanced chiral symmetry in QCD. So this story is a bit involved. And one thing that's involved with it is that these enhanced symmetry transformations of when you go to the massless quark limit, similar to B minus L allowing you to remove this operator form, could potentially allow you to basically do symmetry transformations to remove this operator structure as well. But because quarks are not massless, that doesn't happen. Okay, so there's a lot going on here. So let's try and put the pieces together in a coherent way. Okay, so. Oh. All right. So we can look at the symmetry current with an axial vector current in QCD, or the QCD vector current itself. Okay, so if you just took it, if you just look at lambda QCD, or sorry, LQCD, right, in the massless quark limit, if you didn't transition over to chiral perturbation theory, you just have this operator form, right, taking the masses going to zero for all the quarks that were summed over. And you could basically look at an axial transformation on these fields, right? So you could basically take these fields and take a symmetry transformation of this form with some symmetry parameter, some small number or small parameter, okay? Let's call it this way. So you could do that transformation, right? So if you just do that transformation and plug it in here, then you can kind of just see if you expand out how relate, because of the fact that gamma 5, gamma mu is 0, that you can actually see this transformation canceling. So just explicitly, so if we go to this, then we have on this side an e to the I theta gamma 5 gamma naught. This is just the dagger. I d slash e to the minus I, I'll do this a minus here, theta gamma 5 q prime. Then we have these exponentials, right? So like if you ever want to see explicitly this looking like it's being preserved classically, just expand out the exponential and go order by order and then see what happens. So at leading order, then you just get 1, 1, right? So not a big surprise that this looks fine. The next term, you'll get things like this, theta gamma 5 gamma naught I d slash q prime. There'll be two terms. This one you can then put the gamma naught together, d slash minus I theta gamma 5. And then you just use the commutation properties of gamma naught gamma 5 to basically set this term to 0. And so on and so forth. The higher orders you get for gamma 5, the higher power. Sometimes you get gamma 5 squared. Remember, that trivially goes down to an identity matrix. And when you have odd powers of gamma 5, you can always use this sort of reasoning, order by order in the expansion of the small parameter, to just show that you always get this symmetry transformation being preserved classically. Right? So this axial looks like it's preserved at tree level. And we neglected masses in this limit. So it looks fine. But that's not enough, as we talked about with these sorts of operator forms being generated. You have to worry about the fact that you can do quantum corrections and how quantum corrections affect your conclusions like this. So just like we talked about last time, we can go on to do these sorts of anomaly diagrams to check. Uh, And we'll check if loops also have this U1 axial symmetry. Okay? So what we do is we just similar to the discussion we had last time, is we just develop a symmetry current for the axial current insertion, so it'll be a gamma 5 mu. So we just define this guy. And we can also, instead of, also as well as the axial current, of course, we can always just consider a vector current, right? And we have to think about both currents because of a subtlety that's present here. And of course, we have just QCD itself inserting, you know, the Gell-Mann matrices, summing over all of the fields that we could possibly sum over. We have psi bar alpha, and then the Gell-Mann matrices inserted. So this should be an alpha to the 2 psi, okay? So we can just take these symmetry currents, the QCD guy, and then these sorts of axial and vector ones that would correspond to axial and vector transformations. And we can just put them in these anomaly diagrams with these current insertions. We need the QCD current, of course, if this is going to be gluons now, not the photons that we were thinking about before in the B fields, right? So if we do so, then we can just, in a consistent way, we can calculate the following. Okay, so we define this guy. So let's define t, which is a function of both k and q. This will be a transition. So we'll do a Fourier transform. Q dot y. We'll do a vacuum time order product of these currents. So this one, this axial one, and this can be the QCD one. V, Z, where we're going to have A and B, and we'll have the indices that correspond to mu, alpha, beta. Okay, so we can just define such a thing, which we can then calculate this with these current insertions, this diagram, and this diagram that is crossed to look at the one loop behavior of this in QCD. Okay? So what we want to check, like we checked last time, is things like this. Is this equal to zero once you go beyond tree level? These symmetry currents, are these Ward identities being preserved beyond tree level? So if you wanted to take the vector and axial currents, the two I was defining here, which unfortunately disappeared, and you want to check if this is equal to zero at one loop, and the axial, this is the vector one, sorry, and then this guy is going to be similarly, this should be an alpha. K mu. You can just check to see if these things are explicitly equal to zero by just calculating these diagrams explicitly. Now, if you look at these diagrams, the math here is not terribly involved, but I don't want to waste our time on that. But if you just look at them, what sort of scaling do we have, right? So we have a propagator, the fermion propagator, fermion propagator, fermion propagator. So you know that those go as 1 over k, 1 over k for the loop momentum, 1 over k. And we're going to integrate d4k, right? Or if you want, you could say k slash in the numerator and k squareds. You know, choose your poison in terms of the way you want to think about it. The point is this is linearly divergent, right? So this is a diagram that is divergent. You need to regulate this. You can regulate it with dim ray. You can regulate it in different ways, but it is something that's divergent. Nevertheless, we can calculate it explicitly doing the subtraction that we get, and then just compare what we get in terms of like the finite contributions once we do that regularization. And what we find, similar to the case that we looked at here, is it actually generates operators of this form for QCD with these external gluon fields. Okay? So what you actually find, to be a little bit more explicit, is if you look at these guys, is the following. Because there's a bit of a subtlety here. And I'll define these things in a second. So these are k and q, the external momentum the gluons are carrying. And this one gives 3. So first of all, the operator form that you're seeing here with one momentum and then the epsilon tensor is something which comes out if you just explicitly expand out g mu nu, g mu nu. So you can identify that's what's going on here. And what are these b1s and b2s? So what they are is that there's an ambiguity that happens here. How you choose to route the momentum, different choices you can make. You can just choose different ways to basically do the momentum configuration. And these B1s and B2s are just characterizing different ways you can do this momentum routing. So if you choose to do this momentum routing, you can either set this current to be preserved or this current to be preserved. But you can't make it so that both of them are preserved at the same time. Okay, so basically what this is saying is that there's an ambiguity in these diagrams associated with this linear divergence and then the asymptotic field configurations. And you can choose basically to have either the vector QCD, the vector current preserved, or the actual current preserved, but not both at the same time. So because we have strong, you know, well, basically, there's very strong evidence that the vector current is preserved. You know, there's no experimental evidence. There's no experimental ambiguity associated with that. So we choose to basically make it so the vector current is preserved, and then the actual current is not preserved in QCD. This is one way of seeing it. This is a bit of a fake. I'm not going to go into it. This sort of explicit diagram momentum routing argument, which makes you think that you have this ability to choose essentially where the anomaly lies. If you do a path integral formulation, you can show in a different discussion that this ambiguity actually vanishes. This is, and you do land on the axial current not being preserved robustly. But I'm not going to go into the path integral discussion, okay? But this is what happens. Okay. So what this means is very similar to the case of these diagrams. It's just the math of these diagrams essentially that's telling you that when you put current insertions here of tree level, these tree level current insertions, whether it was the one associated with the baryon number or lepton number, or the ones associated with these QCD vector currents and axial currents, these diagrams essentially make it so that when you return and you evaluate explicitly this matrix element, that you do get, in the case of axial, the axial vector current. Okay, you do get back this structure, which is explicitly this momentum factor here. And then this is just summing over all the fermions, two powers of this, because of the gauge couplings for QCD, 16 pi squared. Essentially, you get back exactly what you would expect. But it's not zero, okay? So this thing is telling you, what this is telling you is that you go through that simple math of doing the commutators, it looks like there's a symmetry transformation that you can do, but the story is a little more involved once you start to take into account quantum corrections. And you have to worry about the fact that this is generated. What does this mean in terms of the actual predictions of the theory? Okay. All right. Now, it's a total divergence, just like in the case of b mu nu, but still that wasn't enough for us to really set things to zero. In the case of b mu nu, it was a total divergence, so it allowed us to re-express it in terms of just one four vector. But we also were using the fact that we had asymptotic field configurations, which were trivial. So let's build that connection up a little more for these non-abelian field strings, okay? Okay. So, all right, this is just a conceptual point here. When we have our background fields that we're doing, so whenever we're doing perturbation theory and when we think about the gauge fields, like when we draw those gluons, and then we're talking about scattering, remember the way we define an S matrix is we have asymptotic scattering states, right? There's some idea that we have some smoothly turning on interactions in the interaction picture. We do scattering, and then we expand out, and then when we go out in terms of external states, we have asymptotic wave functions, right? So there's, in some real sense, there's a background field configurations in terms of all the scattering states that we're doing, right, including the gauge fields. Now, these are fields that they're everywhere in space-time. So you know that you have, so are you aware of the idea of like having vortices in field configurations in terms of so like there's a very simple way to understand it. So like we have fields, background fields, we're doing some scattering. And so because we have fields, if you just think of it in terms of like a simple analogy in terms of a vector field configuration you could write down in all of space-time, not with, you know, quantum field theory, but just think about like water, right? So water can just be, you know, flowing, and you could just have a bunch of sticks in water, right? And those sticks, you could put them all down in the water, could just be flowing a smooth background field configuration, and you could just, you know, they would all be aligned in this way, right? So this is kind of a way of thinking about having a field in space-time. You just have space-time points, and you have an orientation at all space-time points, which is just the sticks as they're flowing, right? So you could have this sort of thing, but you could also have, you know, a whirlpool, right? That's a possibility for having, it's still water as a medium, which defines a vector for all points in space-time, but you could also have, you know, vectors flowing around. And that is also something that you could have in terms of a field configuration that you could be expanding around. So when it comes to quantum field theory, this sort of thing is also possible, right? This is the sort of thing we usually have in our minds for trivial asymptotic field configurations. There's just some wave function. We don't think about some structure like this in the field configurations we're expanding around. But this is also present and possible. And this is something which has a non-trivial topology in this case. You know, you can see in the case of the simple analogy here, if you did angular momentum conservation, you could see that, you know, this could be distinguished from this in terms of, you know, some quantized thing in the field theory. And that actually happens in terms of scattering states. So the way we characterize that is we want to basically have some way of thinking about these asymptotic field configurations, which is related to these operator forms, and look at if they have topology like this or not. Okay? So first of all, we define this guy. So we can define this, which is just going to be a way of basically probing for the asymptotic field configuration. These are the three vectors for some non-abelian field like QCD. So what would this be? This would be like some way of probing the local field structure integrated over all space-time. So it's like some way of trying to measure, you know, whether how all these vectors that can be there in the field configurations, how they, when you have a non-abelian field, once you tie up the color indices, how they actually can, you know, when you integrate over space-time, either give a zero or non-zero value. So it's a way of probing this aspect of the field configurations asymptotically. Okay? So we had this. So we had this being generated. And this is fundamentally related to these sort of asymptotic field configurations because it's a total divergence, right? So let's just rewrite it, okay? So we can take this. We can start with this. And then we can, by defining this, hopefully I got all my indices correct. So you can rewrite this, integrate by parts, and you'll get this out of this expression, okay? This is just expanding one of the field strengths out explicitly and integrating by parts. So this guy you can rewrite explicitly. D mu k with this so defined k, okay? It's a total surface term, just basically taking one of the derivatives out, and just rewriting things. So you can then look at, this was defined at space-time, at a one particular point in time, right? So then you can look at the zero component in time, take those surface configurations, so that you're thinking about a specific time in the sort of scattering events, and then look at what happens with the residual integral over space. Okay? K naught, or take this to be one space-time element, and evaluate at t equals infinity and t equals minus infinity. Okay? And if you do that, you should be able to see directly that this is then going to be an integral over space. And exactly this object we defined here, which had to do with the topology of these field configurations. This is now a vector because we've taken out the one time component. So literally, this was some weird thing that had to do with a surface term. We can define the current, well, the four vector that corresponds to that surface field configuration, do the explicit integral over time, and then we get back this measure of some aspect of, at a particular point in time, how the four vectors are interacting in terms of the wave packets that we're actually scattering. Okay, and this is something that isn't zero when you have non-abelian field configurations which have non-trivial interactions amongst the fields. Okay? So it doesn't have to be something that's zero. Yeah?
So how is it possible that I have like non-trivial configuration and infinity if my fields are short-ranged in QCD?
The fields are short, well, the fields are always defined in space-time. But remember whenever we talked about scattering, remember in field theory, there was always this interaction picture where we basically had some wave function. That was then the wave packets were coming in. And then remember this whole usual discussion that's talked about in the interaction picture where you slowly asymptotically turn on the interactions, do some scattering, and then you go and you have asymptotic field configurations again. So here we're talking about the asymptotic field configurations which are present. But whenever you did scattering events in field theory, this is like very foundational when we were talking about field theory and setting up the S matrix and scattering, it was always the case that you basically had some asymptotic states, some wave functions, like in quantum mechanics, and then we had some interactions that we were turning on to then lead to scattering to other states. So there's always background, there's always field configurations that you're scattering around. We're always doing perturbation theory around something which is really the vacuum system of the system. And what this is getting into is that there can be a non-trivial vacuum structure that you need to worry about when you're doing your scattering, which can lead to physical effects, actually, like this operator, specifically in the case of non-abelian fields. When you have non-abelian fields, you basically have these non-trivial asymptotic field configurations. So I'm going to go on to define for you the vacuum states and how we basically define the vacuum states for the scattering, taking this into account, and you'll see how it's related to this operator form being around. Was that answering or not answering? It was answering, but did it communicate?
but how do I like trust this vacuum? Because if I know that my theory is strongly coupled in the IR, how can I like even trust something like a vacuum?
So what are you worried about? You're worried about that, like, as you go away, you don't have asymptotic quark fields and gluon fields because they get confined? Yeah, so that's true. It's a good question. I don't think I can give you a good answer to it at the moment. There's no reason to think that that QCD becoming strongly coupled would change this story, because okay, so I can give you an answer which will be convincing but is actually technically incorrect. Shall I do that? Okay, so here's an answer I can give you that would be convincing to most people, but there's a technical problem with it, which is that the field configurations that we talk about and these sorts of effects that we talk about are things that the way they show up in the field theory, they do not show up in perturbation theory in the usual way. So they lead to essentially transitions for these different vacuum states, which are described, like I showed you last time, by this exponential with the 1 over g squared, which was something called an instanton effect. So there are things in the field theory related to these topological asymptotic configurations, which are not describable in perturbation theory. So the convincing but technically incorrect argument is that, well, the things you're worried about in QCD are things that are strongly coupled, so that, you know, you're worried about the perturbative expansion in QCD, but these instanton effects to do with topology don't have to do with perturbation theory, so they shouldn't be changed whether we're thinking about the asymptotic states of QCD which are bound or the ones which are, you know, here with free gluon fields and quark fields. So that might have sounded convincing, but there is the problem of, you know, when you go over to the strongly coupled aspect of the theory, it's not actually a sum of the Feynman diagrams. There's the essential singularity, so that the reasoning has that mathematical flaw in it. Well, you could use that reasoning to justify to yourself how these sorts of physics effects, you know, even when you're talking about bound states, would not be changed. But that's why I can't give you a good answer, is because that's very convincing, but not quite. I think that's not a quite correct answer. But anyways, so yeah, that's what I can say. All right, but the point is these operator forms, which were generated directly by these diagrams in the divergence of that symmetry current at one loop, are related to these topological field configurations. So this is called winding number. So this is something called a winding number. Okay. And what this is actually is giving you is the transition from one winding number to another winding number when you actually evaluate it. Okay. So getting to the point which we were just kind of discussing. Okay, so what is then, if these effects can happen and if these effects can be present in terms of the asymptotic nature of the theory, how do we actually define the vacuum states that we're using when we do scattering in QCD? Okay. So essentially, you define them as the coherent sum of all possible topologies, including the trivial topology. That's essentially what you get down to. So a gauge invariant vacuum we always were assuming that there was nothing special about vacuum states. We just assumed they existed. But they actually have to have these effects coherently summed over because they can be present and they can lead to physical consequences. Like things can actually decay because of them. So you define this as this coherent superposition. Where this is a particular topological field configuration. It could be the trivial one. It could be the one that you get when you have like one vortice. It could be the one when you have two or three or four vortices. But this sum is what you actually use to define a certain vacuum. Okay? So you can actually think about this vacuum and you can transfer with some symmetry transformation. You could define a symmetry transformation for one winding number into another winding number in terms of the vacuum. And then if you took this symmetry transformation acting on this one, then you get back e to the I theta. So you can see this explicitly. So let me just do this explicitly for you. So you can define a symmetry transformation that takes you from one winding number vacuum to one with n plus one, so just another topological field configuration. And if you took that transformation on theta, just by explicitly expanding out, you'll get that this gives back just this phase involving this parameter of introduced theta, okay? Sorry, this should be n, but then this becomes theta, okay. So when you actually do scattering, from some theta equals zero vacuum, with some operator that or some interaction, some scattering interaction you want to describe, you integrate over all the field configurations in a path integral description with this operator form. Okay, so then you have to essentially have this integral acting on the sum over, let me just do this. So this scattering is actually a superposition of all of these sort of vacuum states that you could do. And with this description of how these phases come out describing these vacuum states, you can actually get that this is actually equal to a particular phase you would pull out of each of these. So what am I showing you here? We have these topological field configurations that can exist. we do the coherent sum of them to actually define a gauge invariant vacuum when we do our scattering. You can actually do a symmetry transformation from one of these field configurations to another field configuration. That pulls out this phase. But this symmetry transformation had to do with, you know, gauge invariant symmetry transformations between these guys. So if you talk about scattering, you can always do this symmetry transformation on these external states without changing things physically. And then from each of them, you pull out a phase, so you get the relative phase that appears with this parameter for an actual scattering description. So here, we're just describing scattering in QCD the way we were thinking about it, not worrying about this sort of effect. And we just had an e to the I lambda, you know, action derived from lambda QCD. So just an integral. Right? But what this is saying is that when you actually take into account these non-trivial vacuum field configurations, it corresponds to an overall phase that you need to think about. And that overall phase you need to think about, if you just look at this, it looks like something that you could just add and redefine lambda QCD to help to incorporate it in terms of defining the scattering with these field configurations. And that's exactly what you can do. You can just redefine lambda QCD to include this sort of phase effect, which is exactly including the effects of these operator forms. Because these phase transformations had to do with, you know, these vacuum configurations. So, to describe scattering in QCD, the easiest way to deal with this is to just take, you know, LQCD the way we defined it the first day and add to it this operator form. So there's a lot going on here. So I know it gets a bit confusing. There's a lot of layered physics here. So just to remind you again, this symmetry transformation, the axial transformation, it looks like it's preserved at tree level. At one loop, it's not preserved. At one loop, it generates this operator form. And then you ask yourself, what is this? This operator form you can then think about in terms of this four vector. You can integrate by parts, and you can start to understand for a particular evaluation at time, this is probing like the field configurations. So it has to do with the actual field configurations that you're assuming when you're doing scattering. So what you should do when you talk to think about a gauge invariant vacuum is sum over all of those possible field configurations, because you know you can do gauge transformations from one field configuration to another field configuration. So you have to do a summation over all of those sorts of configurations, a coherent sum. And then you start to realize that when you do scattering, taking into account this non-trivial field configuration, that you basically, it corresponds to having an extra phase in the way we usually would describe things in the path integral, which is exactly something which is captured by adding this operator form. Okay? So hopefully that's clear. So now...
Mike?
Yep.
In the you apply to theta state, could you explain again how the phase comes out?
We're just defining this to be a transformation from one winding number state to another winding number state by definition. And this will actually be a gauge transformation. There's actually an explicit form that you can write down, which isn't terribly illuminating, but you can actually, there's actually an explicit one involving Pauli matrices, and you know, you can actually work out exactly what would be the transformation in QCD that will actually change your winding number. It's not illuminating, it's just this weird gauge configuration expression you can do. So there's an explicit representation of this, but what it's telling you is that there's a symmetry transformation, a gauge transformation that takes you from one winding number to another winding number. So just take this as like the way in quantum mechanics we started to think about, you know, having state vectors and acting on them with symmetry transformations. Then just explicitly, if you think about how it acts on one of these, which is the coherent sum, because it does this transformation, it pulls out an explicit phase, which corresponds to theta.
Okay.
I mean, that's really all there is. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It can change n to n plus 1. It doesn't change theta to theta plus 1.
Sorry?
In the exponential, in the next line, it should be n goes to n plus 1, not theta goes to n.
Sorry, you're right. Yeah, I miswrote that. Thank you. Yeah. That's correct. Yes. Yeah, so then you just pull out this explicit guy, this explicit phase. Okay? All right.
Can we talk a little bit more about the winding number?
Yes.
So does this capture, like in a sense, how many vortices I have in my field configuration, or can I think of
it? It was a rough analogy, but yeah, essentially it's like topological structure.
You're mentioning topology. So what does it count? Does it count holes in my field configuration?
You could think of it like that. Yeah, you could think of it as like non, well, you could think it's non-trivial topology. So non-trivial topology, you would have to, you know, define all of the sort of vacuum states and define the topology of those vacuum states. But usually you can think about it in terms of holes, and like it depends on what space you're talking about, what topology corresponds to, right? But it's like the analogy is quite direct, I think, for like the sort of like non-trivial field knots, essentially, that you can build up.
Field knots. So would the vacuum that we wrote, like the zero state, correspond to n equals zero, or correspond to this theta that you take?
So if you want to talk about gauge invariant vacuums, you have to, because you can have gauge transformations transform you to one of these configurations to another configuration, you have to sum over all of them when you talk about scattering in a gauge invariant vacuum.
But the one that we used so far, we just wrote down some amplitude and we just had this zero thing.
That's right, yeah.
What was that? Was that the theta that we write down?
It was this naive thing, neglecting exactly this. Yeah, but now we think about it a little more carefully and we realize that actually there's a phase effect that we need to be careful about.
The phase coming from changing topologies in the field, right?
Yeah, so there's another way of understanding what it is, so which I'm going to get to. But yeah, essentially there's a phase which corresponds to this coherent sum of the actual vacuum state. So when you describe scattering in QCD, you have to describe the QCD Lagrangian, and you have to describe the vacuum state. Okay? So this is just when you actually do describe the vacuum state more carefully, you do pick up this phase that you can think about as just a coefficient of this operator. Okay? Okay.
Mike.
Yep.
So can I see this topological effect like this? So my A at the boundary, so I treat boundary like as either S2 or S3. I don't know which one. I think S3.
It'd be S3, I think, here.
S3, and my map is from S3 to SU3.
Mm-hmm.
And my homotopy group.
So you're breaking it down into an SUN cross a U1.
Yes.
That's right.
So my third homotopy group of SU3 is ZZ3. I guess. Z, sorry.
Okay, possibly. I'm going to go with possibly.
And that's why only integers appear.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the explanation, right?
I think you can think of it that way. Yeah.
And the reason why we don't have these for other groups?
Well, we could have had it for B mu nu, which is an SU2. But it actually had to do with the fact that there was both a baryon and a lepton number current, which each of them had the anomaly, and then the difference of them, the anomaly vanishes. So you can then use that class of symmetry transformations to essentially map all of the vacuum states into one another.
Yeah. But I was wondering, like, Z will be like third homotopy group again of SU2, right?
For Z, sorry, say again?
Third homotopy group of SU2.
Okay.
And is it vanishes or something?
I'm not sure of that in terms of the explanation. I don't think of it that way.
Okay.
Maybe that there's also that. I don't think it's that argument. I think you need to do the symmetry transformations of B minus L to actually argue it away. I don't think it's a pure group theory statement.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it's more than that. Yeah. We need to move forward quickly if we're going to get to these following points. Okay. So. Okay. All right, so I'm going to have to be a bit quick because I want to finish on time for these last two points. Okay, so this was a total divergence, this G mu nu, and we had a symmetry current initially. So you could think, that maybe what the answer is here is that there's some fate going on in the math, and I just didn't have the right symmetry current to start with, right? So you could say, well, I'll take this J5, and I'll just basically redefine it. So I'll make this. So instead of thinking of this J5, which we started off thinking about, why don't I just explicitly subtract this thing? Right? Well, if you do that, then you can actually define a conserved charge. But that's not going to be a gauge invariant, because remember, we had to have all of these field configurations to actually have the gauge invariance of the theory. But it is a conserved charge, even though it's not a gauge invariant structure. So you can transform it with gauge transformations, like these U transformations. Okay, so we can just do this. And you'll transform it by, you know, essentially the sum over the fermions for the field, for the phase transformation. But in the massless quark limit, if we went to the massless quark limit, we can actually use these gauge transformations to do something similar to having the B minus L transformations around, which allowed us to map all of the vacuum states into other vacuum states, to argue that we can remove this requirement of adding this extra term. Okay? So due to lack of time, I think it's better to me show it to you explicitly. So let me show it to you explicitly. Okay? Because this is the last point. So just take the QCD Lagrangian, the standard model Lagrangian, supplemented with this thing. Okay, and remember what happens when we actually take the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. Okay, so remember we had for all of the fermion fields, and then we had minus H dagger for just the quarks, which we'll focus on here. Okay, so we take the Higgs to its vacuum expectation value, and it gives mass terms. Okay, so remember what we did was, for both ups, for all the fields, we did this transformation on the right-handed, well, let's do this. We do this transformation on the left and the right-handed fields to take these mass matrices, which initially had CP violating effects, to diagonal form. Okay, and these were transformations on the left and the right. Okay, so the transformations on the left and the right, remember P left, right, the difference is gamma 5. In terms of P left versus P right. P left versus P right transformations. So you can think about decomposing these transformations, and if you want to have a common phase for the transformation, then the only difference between the left and the right for pulling out that common phase would be what's happening for these, the axial part of the transformation on the mass matrix. Okay? So, yeah. What we did usually was we just said, okay, look, we take the Higgs to its vacuum expectation value, we do these transformations on the left and the right, and then all, and there was possible, there's CP violation in here, you know that that's certainly the case, right? So this was, by doing these transformations, it was all shifted to VCKM by convention. And this is by field redefinition convention. Okay, but the differences in terms of these transformations is really an axial transformation. So there's one last little bit of final point, really running out of time, which is that you can think of this as the masses themselves could have had CP violating contributions, and you could actually write down a general mass term. Here we have a left and we have a right. You could write down a mass in terms of like the real part of the mass and then the axial part of the mass. You could just think of writing that in terms of general form. And then there's an assumption here that you can do these transformations on the axial part of that mass to remove it, or at least shift it just to VCKM. And certainly that's true at tree level, but we just saw that transformations on just axial parts of those field configurations do have this anomaly. So I'm just going to end on this point, which is that if you want to have this mass matrix, so a general mass matrix for the standard model, you were doing these transformations on the lefts. And this is now combining up the ups and the downs mass matrix, just a general mass matrix, and the transformation on the right. And this transformation, if you pull out from here, you decompose this, you can decompose this into an E. So you can decompose this and just pull out a common overall U1 phase. Here you can just do the same sort of thing. And have an overall common U1 phase. And then the difference in these transformations would be an axial phase shift. So doing that transformation explicitly in terms of this mass matrix, then this overall phase in the mass matrix, you end up with a mass matrix where the argument, by definition, you make the mass matrix real and diagonal. So you basically take, and then this mass matrix, remember, had these transformations. So you have to do this argument determinant on all the transformations. And what you end up with at the end of the day is that two number of fermions, the difference in the transformation on the right and the left, of the mass matrix is then equal to zero. So this overall transformation is just the argument, it's just the overall phase in the determinant that was in the mass matrix. And that is actually also what gets shifted into this defined theta. So this theta is picking up this. And if you had a massless field, this would vanish explicitly, right? Okay. So I'm out of time. The only thing I wanted to say is one last point, which is that we can actually measure this physical parameter, which is the combination of this guy and then this phase that can be in the mass matrix. And it's related to something that we can actually measure. It's called the electric dipole moment. So we can actually measure this, and it works out. You can work it out. Well, I'm not gonna worry about the number. I'm just gonna say this. In terms of the known masses of the standard model, and it's a calculable effect in the standard model, it's parameterizable, it's essentially in the standard model, it's 10 to the minus 15 times this parameter comes into the electric the dipole moment, whereas this is measured to be 12 orders of magnitude smaller than you would naively expect if this was order one. Okay, so we've already taken into account the loop effect in terms of its definition. It's not going to make this discrepancy, arguable discrepancy, go away. So that, understanding that in terms of Y in the standard model, as far as we can tell, all the parameters that we have, there are certain things which are small in the standard model, right? There's things that we find, like gauge couplings, which we find from input parameters. There's CKM transition matrix elements, which we find from measuring the decays of mesons and how they transition to one another. They're less than one at times. Some of the Yukawas are small, 10 to the minus 3, in terms of their numbers. But we have nothing as small that can be, you know, just sitting there in the standard model as this parameter. So actually explaining why this is as small as it is something that people actively work on, particularly here, actually. It's called the strong CP problem. So it's not obviously something which should be exactly zero. It does have a limit where it goes to zero when the quark masses go to zero. It's associated with CP violation. But we know CP violation in the standard model is non-zero. And the smallness of how it shows up in terms of experimental measurements in the standard model when it's the CP violation in the CKM matrix had to do with a lot of those powers of the mass differences and the CKM factors that came into actually doing those transition matrix elements. So this is an unknown discrepancy, or it's a mystery in terms of people's mindsets as to why this ends up being as small as it is. There's no dynamical reason in the standard model it's known to be non-zero. You might think that all of this sort of discussion was such that it was just some weird math thing we were convincing ourselves of in field theory, but it doesn't actually lead to physical effects. But with this sort of reasoning, you can also look at things like certain pion decays, which is how they first discovered this. And the same sort of reasoning leads to the pion decaying in terms of two photons, for example, which we didn't have time to go into. But so it's not that this reasoning is just intrinsically somehow wrong, and it doesn't lead to measurable effects that are the size that we expect them to be in other sort of things we test. So it's not that it's just intrinsically incorrect reasoning. Something's going on to make this parameter so much smaller than we expect. But we don't know what it is. So that was a bit sketchy because there's a lot of physics that comes into this. Are there any questions? Yeah?
So does the one number, does it start from zero or one?
It's usually one, yeah. Yeah. So it's just like some configuration. Yeah.
So is this theta one of the parameters that we mentioned, like from 18? No, right?
No, it's an extra one. Yeah. So that was a miscount, because what we were doing in that miscounting was we were basically saying, look, we have masses, right? So there was always an assumption that this sort of tree level transformation, so there's the words of you do a transformation on the left and the right, and you take a matrix to real diagonal form, and that's true. And that is the consequence of you getting down to a real diagonal mass matrix. But because these are left and right-handed fields where the difference is the gamma 5, that transformation that you're doing at tree level, you have to worry about, you know, how that transformation was essentially an axial transformation, which you're assuming you can do with arbitrary freedom, how it behaves in sort of perturbation theory. And when you actually worry about that, it ties you into this whole story, and then you have another way of just basically shifting what could be another phase that could be present, which isn't shifted into this in terms of the way it shows up in terms of other other measurements, and it could show up just in terms of this operator form, which would be showed up with which you could then probe experimentally with other experiments. So there was an implicit assumption when we were counting to get to those 18 parameters that we just had the masses, the real masses. And we were neglecting this ambiguity, this issue. So there's actually one more. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just this board, the last board, could you overview what did we do? So like, okay, from CKM part is clear.
Mm-hmm.
But like the overview, what did we do on this last board?
Okay, I ran out of time a little bit. So we argued that the standard model had this operator form. And you know that there was a further transformation that we were doing in the standard model, the way we're describing things, which is assuming that we can take these remember these math. So fundamentally, where does this phase come from and what is it about, right? Do we just write it down like this? So fundamentally, you can think of it as also being related to the fact that we have masses here. If we were to not make the assumption that we can basically do this axial transformation, if we said we can't do that transformation, then when we did these rotations, what we would do is we would say, well, we do this rotation, we get to a real diagonal mass matrix, but then we could have a mass term with a gamma 5, because we then aren't allowing ourselves to assume that we can always remove that by the rotation. So that would be an ambiguity that's around, that's left over after we did the shift of the CP violation to CKM. Okay, and that bit, you can basically say, well, that bit is present. And you can then basically say, well, okay, if that bit is present, and then we actually take the masses that we see to real diagonal form, you can relate that ambiguity in terms of the gamma 5 mass to this sort of phase shift directly. And then what we see in terms of this, and that axial transformation you saw get shifted into this operator form. So if we don't make that assumption that we can do this transformation in a way that works with perturbative corrections, there, when we do this and we do our mapping to real diagonal masses, there's an extra shift of complex phases that could start here. And then what we measure here is the combination of theta, which comes from this general argument, plus this mass shift, which this phase, which comes out of the mass matrix fundamentally. I ran out of time to do this more carefully, but that's essentially what's going on. So it's also related to the fact, I don't want to add more confusion, but is there any other questions? Yes.
So we wrote down this operator, and mm-hmm. is the idea that we try to say that this theta is related to the CKM CP violation?
No, it's an extra CP violating effect.
So we have
What we were just discussing. Yeah, there's two. Yeah, that's right. So the way we were discussing it before, had an implicit assumption that actually fails once you start to be careful about quantum mechanical corrections. And that implicit assumption was that we could always do this transformation to lefts and rights with impunity and not worry about the fact that we were doing these sorts of rotations. So the difference of rotating to the lefts and the rights is a gamma 5 difference. Okay, so if you pull out an overall phase to worry about that, and you start to follow that phase, then you find that when we do, because we can always take our masses to real diagonal form by definition, but where does, you know, we also shift then a little bit of something which could initially be here in terms of these lefts and rights, because this is a complex number to start with. There's an extra little bit that we can shift in terms of the observed CP violation into this theta parameter, as opposed to into VCKM. Okay? So VCKM, that phase, you remember, had to do with the 3-1 and 1-3 elements in the CKM matrix. And there were some small numbers there. They were like 0.2 and such, but nothing was 10 to the minus 12. So that's a source of CP violation. And we saw how it came into like various meson mixing diagrams in a very controlled way with combinations of CKM matrix elements and mass differences with the Jim mechanism. So part of the smallness of the unitarity triangle had to do with, you know, the fact that it was like 3 generations and you had like a whole bunch of CKM factors as well as mass differences getting into experimental results. But it wasn't intrinsically small like this. But there's another phase, another aspect of CP violation that's still present, and it's here. And it's a combination of just that parameter being there to start with, and then this shift that you can get from the mass matrix. And it's another source of CP violation, which is also possible. And this one, unlike the case of the CP violation coming from the CKM matrix element, it's intrinsically small in a way that we don't know why, right? I mean, this 10 to the minus 15 takes into account mass factors and that sort of things, which led to smallness in CP violations observation for CKM effects. That's already here in terms of the known masses. So this is like the parameter itself intrinsically is really small. And it's not obvious at all why. That's an outstanding. I mean, I wouldn't call it an inconsistency in the standard model, because it's just like, well, it could be. I mean, the parameters are whatever they are, right? But that's just kind of strange, right? Why you would think that why is this as small as it is? So the people build models and they extend the standard model to basically make this dynamically be relaxed to zero. People here are experts on that sort of thing. Yeah, we're over time. Let's not go over.
We'll hear more about it in particle physics.
Yeah, you've seen how they talk about it. I just wanted to set it up for them in terms of framing the discussion. I think they'll talk about it in more detail in the follow-up class, quite a bit more, I think. I just wanted to give you the idea that just from the standard model perspective itself, this is standard model physics, and where, you know, it's just there. So we made some assumptions when some of the discussions we had before, which actually, if you're a little more careful with loop corrections, there's a very subtle, long story as to why some of those actually fail, those assumptions. But that's the extent of the dirt, neutrino masses and the strong CP problem, demanding explanations. Other questions? We're already over time, we should go. But okay, let's be done.
Thank you, Mike.
Yep.